We all want it, and we know that money can't buy it. This hour, we'll find out what we do know about what really makes us happy. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, the pursuit of happiness. According to a Gallup poll, Iowa is the 10th happiest state in the Union. We'll find out why that is. We'll also talk about how we can use money to increase happiness and talk about other changes we can make in our lives that might just make us happier. We also want to hear from you. What changes have you made in your life that have made you happier? Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We all want to be happy, and we want the people we love to be happy, but happiness can be elusive and difficult to define. This hour, I'll talk with a number of scientists and researchers who've worked hard to try to unlock the mysteries of happiness. And later in the hour, Gretchen Rubin, who's best-selling author of The Happiness Project, will be with us. And we want to hear from you this hour as well. What changes have you made in your life in an effort to be happier? And has it worked? You can join us and tell your story at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're going to start the hour with Ryan Howell, who's Associate Professor of Psychology at San Francisco State University. He's also co-founder of beyondthepurchase.org. Hello, Ryan.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And you have been involved in the research behind what is called the Gross Domestic Happiness Index. Tell me what that is.
So most of the work that has been done over the last, say, 70 to 80 years to look at human progress has really focused on some relatively simple economic metrics. And that's where the gross domestic product comes from, or GDP. And what we have been advocating really for probably the better part of the last 15 years is that if you're going to look at the progress of a society, you should look at how well people are feeling about their lives as one of those indicators. And so it's not supposed to replace the other types of metrics that are looking at the progress of society, but trying to supplement it so that we can look at policies that will help us feel better about our lives and ensure that our lives are actually of higher quality when we implement new policies.
Now, in looking at the Gross Domestic Happiness Index online, I see that I can take the survey. Was there a scientific sample to try to come up with some sort of index, or is this something that people have just participated in if they were curious?
Well, a little of both. So there were actually five samples that were or five surveys that were conducted. It is a very thorough process to actually develop items that actually measure the constructs that we're interested in. So if you're looking at something like quality of life, you don't want to just pick questions sort of out of a hat and assume that they're good. You need to ensure that they're reliable, that they're valid. There's a lot of painful psychometric processes that you have to go through that I won't bore you or your guest with, but you can be assured that it actually is an incredibly reliable and valid survey to measure 10 different domains of well-being. And that's one of the nice things about these indicators is that they're not just looking at the sort of ephemeral happiness, but looking at quality of life from a really broad swath.
One of the most notable things that came to my mind when I was looking at this survey is that you've broken it down in many different ways, but people seem to get happier as they get older under a number of different categories.
Right, and there's a lot of research that backs this up. There's actually, if you look at the trends across pretty much every developed country that we know of, happiness has an unfortunate U-shaped curve, and that sounds very depressing for those of us like myself who are approaching our mid-40s. Basically, your happiness starts off pretty high in your early 20s and starts going downhill almost immediately after that until it hits its nadir at somewhere between, say, 44 and 48 or so. And then it stops and starts going back up. there's been a lot of work that's been examined to try and determine why this might be. We have proposed that, older is wiser, that you certainly get to a point where certain things start mattering more to you, and you start allocating more time and resources to those things, like your friends and your family. Maybe you stop worrying so much about trying to impress people. And by doing that, you more automatically do things that will actually make you happier. So it's not that you can't be happier before you're in your mid-40s, but maybe those are just the times in our lives that we evaluate ourselves and make sure that we really are picking the types of things that are most important.
Well, and I'm sure there are so many factors that go into it. I mean, thinking about it, those early years in the 20s and 30s, we're so busy and we're working so hard. Mm-hmm. And then we add in kids to that. And it's just such an incredible grind. But it's nice to know that things get better.
Yeah, and one of the things, so children are really interesting, and there's been a ton of relatively recent research done by some of my colleagues in the field of positive psychology, sort of looking at the impact that children have on our well-being. And I think one of the most interesting articles that came out had one of the best titles as well. It's Children, All Stress and Awe. And I think that if you ask, I'm a a father of an 18-month-old. I think if you ask a parent, especially of a toddler, that those are two emotions that they can feel quite often, a lot of stress because raising a child is very difficult, but also this sort of high sense of awe. And I think that really highlights what is important in getting a complete measure of well-being across progress. Because if you just look at sort of moods or emotions, you might say something like, well, children really stress us out, and therefore there might be some, drawbacks to that. But you have to look at some of the more moral emotions as well to sort of understand where at least the happiness benefits are. There's obviously quite a few benefits to people's well-being outside of just happiness from having children.
Now, we are going to talk to every single guest this hour about money, because although we know, because we say it all the time, that money does not buy happiness, a lot of us spend a lot of our lives in pursuit of money. So when you look at these indexes and you do these surveys, what is the correlation between how much money you make and have and your level of happiness?
Well, so this is a very complicated question. So we hear things like money can't buy happiness, or the pursuit of money will ultimately make you unhappy. And I think that there's two things that are really important to realize. One, there is a positive correlation between money and happiness. And for those statisticians out there, the correlation runs, depending on how you measure it, anywhere from about 0.1 to 0.4 in our data. And so it is true that people are, when they're wealthier, they tend to say that they're happier. Of course, there's a lot of people who are happy who are not very wealthy, and there's people who are wealthy that are not very happy. And what we have tried to do as a result of that is change the question and basically say the average American has somewhere between about 40 to 60% of their income as disposable, and so that they can make choices with that income. And it's really not how much money you have that we see that makes you happy. It's how you allocate those resources that can make you happy. So spending your money in ways that will bring you closer to your friends and family is probably one of the most important keys to buying happiness.
And I want to dig into that a little bit deeper as the hour goes on. And Ryan, stay with us. I want to bring Dean Witters into the conversation now. He is research director for the Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index. And according to this Gallup poll, some people say that Iowa is the 10th happiest state in the union. But more specifically, we rank number 10 among states on this well-being index. Dan Witters is here with me now. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here today. And, I know that some people are saying we're the 10th happiest state in the union. This is not exactly a happiness survey, but I know that there are a lot of factors that contribute to our well-being that also fall under that umbrella of things that make us happy. So what are some of the factors that you measure in the index?
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning the more broad definition, because this is a 55-question instrument. It does include emotional health. We've got 12 different metrics that are a part of that. Yes, daily happiness is one of those metrics, but we hit on a variety of different things from positive to negative daily affect and emotions. We also have physical health metrics. We look at healthy behaviors. Those are granular things that a lot of people think about when they think of well-being, smoking, exercise, eating right. We look at things like basic access, having access to basic needs, enough money for food and medicine, feeling safe walking around, easy access to fresh fruits and vegetables, having health insurance. And we also ask people to evaluate their lives. Just how do you think that you'd place your life on a ladder with 10 rungs where the top rung is your best possible life? So the well-being index is multifaceted, and Iowa, in fact, was ranked 10th in the nation in 2013 in overall well-being.
Now, people who live in Iowa probably think, yeah, we know this about Iowa. It's a pretty great place to live. I know not everybody feels that way. But then they look at the index and they think, North Dakota's number one.
Yeah.
That probably came as a shock to a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's something I've gotten a lot of questions about. It's not a big surprise to those of us that have paid attention to the well-being index, and few have more than I have in recent years. North Dakota is a high well-being place. It's never been number one before, but it's been in the top 10 multiple times. It's been as high as number two. And so it's the fact that it's moved up to number one wasn't a big shocker. North Dakotans are pretty hardy folk. They have very high physical health. They take good care of themselves. They don't live perfect lives. But there's a lot of good things going on in North Dakota. And to the point of your previous question about money buying happiness, yes, well-being does climb with income. That'll vary somewhat depending on what metric you're looking at. So some metrics will move more with income than others. But the booming economy in North Dakota, low unemployment rates, and elevating household incomes, that also will lend a buoyancy to those well-being scores.
And how long have you been tracking this well-being index?
That's a great question. The well-being index has been going on since 2008. That's when Gallup and Healthways began our partnership. These are all outbound phone interviews. We do half landline and half cell. You have to include the cell because about a third of us are cell only now in America. We do English and Spanish. So that gives us about 96% coverage of all American adults. We go every single night of the year except major holidays. So 350 nights a year, random sample of American adults. We're over 2 million and counting. We're doing 500 a night these days. So we capture a very big set of data. It's one of a kind, and it enables us to sort respondents according to all different criteria, including geography, including cities and states. So in 2013, we had over 2,300 randomly selected Iowan adults.
Okay,
as a part of our survey.
Dan, we have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about happiness. With me is Dan Witters, Research Director for the Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index. We'll continue our conversation in a moment.
Sunshine, she's here. You can take a break. I'm a hot air balloon that could go to space. With the air, like I don't care, baby, by the way. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth. Because
it's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about happiness, and I'm talking with a number of different researchers about some of the different factors that we know go into making us happier people. We'll also talk in a few minutes with Gretchen Rubin, who's best-selling author of The Happiness Project, who set out to make herself happier and has learned a lot of things along the way. We also want to hear from you this hour. If you've made changes in your life, in order to be a happier person, let us know. Maybe it worked, maybe it didn't, but we'd love to hear your story. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can post on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, and you can call at 866-780-9100. Ryan Howell is with me. He's waiting on the line to come back into the conversation in just a few minutes. He's Associate Professor of Psychology at San Francisco State University. And right now I'm talking with Dan Witters, who is Research Director for the Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index. And Dan, before the break, we were talking about the fact that you've been researching well-being. You've been conducting these surveys now since 2008. And I know it's not a long time in terms of seeing a trend, but do you see an increase in well-being?
Nationwide, no. Nationwide is pretty flat. Well-being did come down with the Great Recession. As you might expect, that didn't hit all elements of well-being, but it did hit some. That has since recovered. By 2011, the nation was pretty much fully recovered from the well-being effects of the recession, if not recovered from other elements of it. Iowa, on the other hand, is an interesting case because Iowa is one of just a handful of states, your listeners will be interested to know, that have improved. So if you start at 2010, say the first full year since the official end of the Great Recession, and just look at that baseline, Iowa is one of just a handful of states that have improved every year since 2010. In fact, it's just one of four states that have improved every year and are also top 10 in both 2012 and 2013. I think that adds a little verve to the statistic because these aren't low-ranking states that are just moving up into the middle. These are pretty high well-being places that are nevertheless still getting better as we measure it with our comprehensive instrument.
Do we have any idea what some of the factors are that go into Iowa actually climbing there?
Sure. I mean, and some of them have to do with the so-called Focus 5, which is a big part of the Iowa Healthiest State Initiative. Mm-hmm. Some of your listeners may be familiar. This is a public-private partnership. Wellmark sponsors it. Hy-Vee supports it. Governor Branstad, and especially Lieutenant Governor Reynolds, really speak it up, and we appreciate their public support. But there are five metrics in particular that the Healthiest State Initiative has been focusing on, and each one of them have improved since our baseline year of 2010. That was kind of the last year before this whole thing got launched. That includes learning something new or interesting, which is a lot of people don't think about, but a very important psychological need, a real vanguard of high well-being places. It's one reason why college towns tend to rank so high in well-being, because there's a lot of learning and growing going on among the people who live there. That one's gotten a lot better. Another one that we look at is my supervisor at work treating me like a partner rather than bossing me around. Very important metric of work life. Not all of us, of course, are in the formal economy, but for those of us who are, our workplace has a big influence over our overall well-being, and that's a really important metric that drives it. Iowa has improved pretty substantially in that metric. And another one I'd call out is getting to the dentist. Another one that people don't think about a lot real intuitively when they think about wellness or well-being or happiness. But good oral health is a really important one. People with poor oral health have all kinds of negative downstream physical health outcomes that spills into negative emotional health outcomes. So after you control for all the other demographics, it makes a big difference. Plus, people who take good care of their teeth just think about and evaluate their lives better. So oral health is important. Getting to the dentist is important. About 70% of Iowans have been to the dentist in the last 12 months. That's quite a bit better now than the national average. You still got 3 out of 10 that need to go. So if you haven't been to the dentist lately, make an appointment.
Go,
it's important for your well-being.
Yeah. And for and for our ranking as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Oh, well, thank you so much for sharing this research with us today, Dan.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dan Witters is Research Director for the Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index. And that doesn't exactly speak to happiness, but we are talking about happiness this hour, and well-being is an important part of that as well. I want to bring someone new into the conversation now. Dave Gould is an Obelman Center public scholar. He teaches a life design class at the University of Iowa, and he is also Director of Imagination for the Downtown Project in Las Vegas. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Howard. It's nice to be on your program.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today. And I know you work with a lot of young people. And we were talking earlier, I was talking with Ryan about how people tend to be happier as they age. When you talk to young people about their expectations for what will make them happy in life, what kind of ideas do your students have about what they want to get out of life?
You know, I'll say there's been an evolution in that. I would say 10, 15 years ago, when I first had conversations with my students talking about what constituted a good life, I believed many of them had bought into the notion, hook, line, and sinker, that that money did. They were often in majors that they saw as practical, whether they were passionate about them or not. They were interested in pursuing professions that would yield large incomes, again, whether they were passionate and cared about them in a deep personal level or not, feeling that that was the way that they should, you know, they should kind of journey through life. And I've seen a shift in that. As your earlier guest mentioned, I don't think any of my students want to live a life where they struggle, where they're worried about having their car repossessed and, you know, putting food on the table. They also are carrying large student debts, so there certainly is some concern about how they're going to repay those on the other side of a graduation ceremony. But I see a real calling for them to want to live meaningful lives. They want to have places where they're fulfilled. They want to have places where they're doing things important. They want to make a difference in the world. And I see that as an ingredient that is a kind of a louder voice in this generation now than, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago.
From your experience, Dave, there understand that having a job you like, doing something that you enjoy, is important to us, but does it make an even bigger difference if it's something that you feel is meaningful?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, your earlier guest talked about some of the science of happiness and some of the pioneers in the positive psychology, and they, you know, they talk about, obviously, you know, finding something you get lost in, something that you truly kind of makes you come alive. But when you're able to take that and turn it towards something larger than yourself, I would argue that that's the deepest, most meaningful life you can live. And so helping students, you know, at our institution there at the University of Iowa or at any institution, discover what they care about, what really matters to them, and then helping them turn them towards something larger, I think is one of the deepest ways you can live.
Now, you are working right now in Las Vegas with Tony Hsieh to really reinvent that community, Tony Hsieh of Happiness, and you're working to make it a happier, more livable community. What factors in our environment seem to really influence our happiness?
Well, this really, so I met Tony Hsieh in the fall of 2010 when he actually, ironically enough, to your program, was out on a book tour with his book Delivering Happiness. Mm-hmm. It was largely about his experiment with Zappos, which is a workplace that's truly built on that kind of objective. And he has begun here. It's I've been here now about a year, commuting back and forth between Iowa City and Las Vegas, watching what I would say is probably one of the most interesting social experiments taking place. You know, Tony has initially really purchased about 19 blocks of downtown Las Vegas, invested about $350 million of his own money, excuse me, into the initiative, and is putting it in lots of areas. So, you know, there's the $200 million in real estate, but there's $50 million in arts, education. He's a very, very big proponent of co-learning. And how does a city learn? He's building models in education. He's building a model healthcare, a model mass transportation, $50 million in small business startups, largely to people who would not be able to get loans, and done in a very venture capital way where they, if they fail, they don't get paid, need to be paid back. So there's a low risk to the people that are, actually no risk to the people that are taking those on. And so it's this fascinating social experiment where building a community where not only do you have this kind of entrepreneurial spirit where people are actually engaged in things that they care about and trying to participate in the economy, but at the same time building in the kind of supports and social constructs that that make it very livable and a good life.
For you personally, I mean, you live in Iowa much of the time. Now you're spending your time dividing between Iowa and Las Vegas. How does that impact your personal happiness? We were talking about how Iowa, in many ways, is a very good place to live on the well-being index and on the happiness scale. Las Vegas doesn't measure up quite so well so far.
Well, you know, I love Iowa City, and that is my home. It'll always be my home. And And so I it's a joy to every time I come back and I'm there. But what I find so fascinating here, Charity, is the opportunity to learn. Because as you mentioned, not only is this one of the most interesting social experiments taking place, but it's happening in a city that is incredibly vulnerable. Arguably, the worst hit city in the 2008 recession, has one of the worst educational systems, a huge homeless population, very little to no supports for things like mental illness. So to see this experiment, if you will, unfold in a place where there's great need is an incredible learning experience for me. And I believe when we speak about happiness, well, obviously there's things we can do on a personal basis, and we all try to do. We all, as you said at the top of your program, struggle to live a happy life. I think that, you know, there's a question that I certainly have been raising in my mind, which is, you know, can I truly be happy if you're not? And so for the trying to raise the bar, if you will, for a lot of people that are struggling, and again, with new systems and kind of a new innovation, is to me a fascinating place to be and to witness happen.
Well, Dave, stay with us. Ryan's hanging on the line as well, and we're going to bring you guys together in a few minutes. But I want to introduce now Gretchen Rubin, who is the best-selling author of The Happiness Project and Happier at Home. She blogs online at GretchenRubin.com about different subjects related to happiness. Hello, Gretchen.
Hello, I'm very happy to be talking to you.
Thank you so much. Now, when you started this Happiness Project, you were not what you would have considered to be an unhappy person, but you felt like you could be happier. What did you set out to do?
Well, that's exactly right. And I think some people assume that you need to be in a place of deep unhappiness or crisis before you turn your attention to having a happier life. But what I found from talking to a lot of people is that a lot of people were like me, where they consider themselves pretty happy. But then when you look for it, you realize that there's a lot of pretty low-hanging fruit. There's a lot of things that we can do without a lot of time, energy, or money that will make us happier. And, you know, and why not do that if you have the opportunity? So I decided that I would spend a year really learning everything that I could from ancient philosophy to contemporary science about how to live a happier life and put it into action and see if it really made a difference, and to see what worked. And so that was my happiness project.
And you did take an incredibly studious approach to this, reading so much, doing so much research. But can you tell me about a couple of the changes that you decided to implement in your life?
Well, you know, some of it is so basic. And, you know, even things like getting enough sleep turns out to be, you know, one of these things that so many people are like, well, I've trained myself to get by on 5 hours, but over and over, studies show people think that they're fine, but they really aren't. And that just like looking at these very, very basic elements of your life. So making sure that I went to bed and so that I got my at least 7 hours of sleep made a huge difference. Another thing that, you know, again, contemporary science and ancient philosophers agree on is that really, if you had to pick one thing, if you really were forced to pick just one aspect of life, relationships are a key to happiness. You know, to be happy, we have to have enduring, intimate, strong relationships. And so I did a lot of things from like, you know, starting a new book group, to making sure that I email with my sister more often, or making sure that I kiss my husband every morning and every night. Little things like that to just strengthen and broaden my relationships ended up being, you know, easy and fun, and also having a surprisingly significant happiness effect.
Now, a lot of what you describe in your life, not just getting to bed at a reasonable time, but you also get up earlier than you used to.
Yep.
And obviously having a very high level of organization seems to make you happier. When I was reading about some of the things that you do on a daily basis, making your kids' lunches the night before, making sure you get that 10-minute pickup done before bed, all the decluttering and all that, I felt a little overwhelmed and exhausted just reading this stuff. But for you, that's made a real difference.
Well, I have to say, the book that I'm working on now is all about habit formation. And one of the things that I learned about myself is that I am turns out, very small number of people who have a very high, like, aptitude for habit formation. Now, I thought I was pretty typical. And when I did my happiness project, I was like, whoa, this is great. And now I understand, you know, I'm kind of on the freaky fringe. I thought I was the average person. And so I think most people who read this, they don't do it in the kind of systematic way that I do it. And, you know, they pick three, four, five things that jump out at them, and that's enough. And then they get those things under control, and then maybe they do the next thing. But certainly, you know, the book is sort of like, I try all this stuff so you don't have to, and I've learned that most people really aren't interested in doing it to that level.
Well, I did think, well, maybe this is happiness for type A personalities.
And it's just some people liked that they just feel they like that better. And then some people, you know, some people really resist that. They want to feel free. They want to make choices every day. So they're going to want to set up their life differently. And you're putting your finger on something that's absolutely key to happiness, which is so much about it is self-knowledge, and that there's no one magical answer that works for everyone. I say, make your bed, and that works for me, and it seems to work for a lot of people. Other people love not making their bed, you know, just to pick kind of a silly example.
Right.
But it's to know yourself, because when our life reflects our own values, our own interests, our own temperament, that's when we become happy. There's no get up early. For some people, don't get up early. You need to figure out how you can sleep later, because you're a night person, and you're never going to make yourself a morning person. And so don't try to copy the habits of somebody else. Figure out what works for you, what makes you happier. And so really this idea of learning about yourself and figuring out what are the things that make you happier. Maybe you need to let go of a fantasy of, you know, maybe you think you love
Gretchen, we're
camping.
Gonna, right. Yeah. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. And we're going to bring all three of our experts together. Right now I'm talking with Gretchen Rubin, who is best-selling author of The Happiness Project. And we'll continue our conversation about happiness in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
I lost that love before, got mad and closed the door, but you said, child, just once more. I chose you for the one, now we're having so much fun. You treated me so kind, I'm about to lose my mind. You made me so very happy. So glad you came into my life.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the pursuit of happiness, and I have three happiness experts on the show with me right now. Ryan Howell is Associate Professor of Psychology at San Francisco State University. He's also co-founder of BeyondThePurchase.org and was involved with developing the Gross Domestic Happiness Index as well. Dave Gould is here with us. He's an Olbermann Center public scholar. He teaches a life design class at the University of Iowa and is Director of Imagination for the Downtown Project in Las Vegas. Gretchen Rubin is also here. She is the best-selling author of The Happiness Project and Happier at Home. She blogs online at GretchenRubin.com. And we want to hear from you this hour as well. What kind of changes have you made in your life that have affected your happiness? Have you done something intentionally to make yourself a happier person? Has it worked? Share your story. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And now, Gretchen, you wrote a best-selling book, which I think would make somebody a little bit happier. But beyond that, do you feel like the changes that you have made in your life have really affected your level of happiness?
Absolutely. And, you know, when I'm just sort of lying in bed at night, I'm the same person that I always was, which is sort of neither ebullient nor melancholic. I'm just sort of a 7 on a 1 to 10 scale. But the way that my daily life is so much happier, because I have less anger and boredom and resentment, and I have more fun and more friends and, you know, more meaning. And so it really did make quite a difference in my everyday life.
We have this comment from Becky on Facebook. She says, 4 years ago, I quit the hubbub of the nursing field, the stress of thousands of regulations imposed on facilities, which we need, has frightened so many companies that they constantly instill the fear in the staff. I now work part-time for my church, and I go home with a positive outlook. And Dave, we were talking about how important it is for somebody to feel like they're doing something meaningful with their life. Now, nursing is something meaningful, but the stress of the job sounds like it was something that was really sucking a lot of happiness out of Becky's life. How does that play into it?
Well, it plays hugely into it. And, you know, you can be doing something as a profession that's noble and wonderful and fulfilling and, in fact, something you really love. But if the workplace is oppressive and stressful, if the hours are long and they take away from the time for your family and friends and the things you love to do outside of the marketplace, the end result could be very, very different. And so, you know, these are in some ways almost two different issues. It's finding what you're passionate about doing, but it's also to live a happy life, I would argue. It's creating workplaces that are engaging and joyful and connect us with one another, which also, by the way, can mean profitable. So, again, when I mentioned the example of Zappos, which when that was first created and this idea of employees actually having a place where they're fulfilled and happy to go to, that was a very revolutionary idea. But I would argue, certainly with the students that I see coming through our university right now, I would argue that that's exactly the marketplace, the workplace that they want to be engaged in.
I want to go to the phones now. Kurt is on the line in Mount Pleasant. Hi, Kurt.
Hello.
Hi. What did you want to talk about?
I wanted to comment that you cannot search for happiness, that happiness is a byproduct of right living.
Okay.
That if you work each and every day doing the right thing, that one day you'll wake up and realize, hey, I'm happy. happiness is something you can't search for. You have to work for it each and every day.
All right, Kurt, thanks a lot for that comment. And Gretchen, I'm sure you've heard that from a lot of people.
Yeah, there's a rich tradition, and there's like 15, you know, eminent minds from history who have said exactly what the caller said. But I have to say that I disagree, because I think that the things that you would do to get happiness as a byproduct are exactly the things that you would do if you were directly aiming at happiness. And I think we tend to hit a target better when we have it in mind and we're really thinking about it. So, I mean, I think sometimes people assume that if you were trying to be happy, you'd spend all your time drinking margaritas at the beach. But I don't think anybody actually thinks that that is what would be the happy life. I think people understand that it's meaning and connection and things like this. And so, to me, at least, I feel like having those things explicitly in mind allows me to shape my life in a more mindful way.
And in reading some of your work, I was struck also by some of the comments that you've made about, you know, don't treat yourself, don't cut yourself slack, don't give up on something, because it will make you happier in the long run if you do that workout or you stick to your diet.
Well, it's interesting. I actually think that deciding to treat yourself in ways that are healthy then will help you do the things like eat healthfully and exercise. So I think you have to think about it and like, how do I create a situation for myself where I feel like I'm getting the treats that I want, so that I have the, if you give more to yourself, you can demand more from yourself. And I think a lot of times people say things like, I deserve this, I earn this, I need this, as an excuse to break their habits. Whereas if they get something, if they give themselves a little bit of a healthy treat, then they can do things that in the long run will pay off with more happiness, but that maybe demand a little bit of self-command in the short term.
Anthony's on the line in Fredericksburg. Hi, Anthony.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with your panelists more. I mean, I wholeheartedly think that it's a mental state to be happy. It's just a choice that I choose to make every day. I mean, I have bad days, but I still I'm still really polite to other people. If I'm in the line at a grocery store and someone's there buying milk, I'll buy the milk for them. Just these small little subtle things that I do make me feel better about myself, in turn make me, you know, kind of portray it outwards, you know, trying to like the law of attraction, I guess.
Well, and Anthony, was there a point in your life where you made that choice? Did you say, you know what, I will feel better if I approach my day in a different way?
Oh, most definitely. About 6 years ago.
What was it that gave you the inspiration?
I was just tired of feeling the way that I felt, and I started, you know, doing some reading, getting some more knowledge, and then I just went with that, and I just kept doing it. And every now and then, I get this idea like, "Hey, this would be, you know, a great thing to do." So I do it, and it turns out, you know, it was. It's a great thing to do. I mean, I'm not exactly rich, but you know, I can afford $3 for a gallon of milk for somebody else. And that in turn makes me happy, and I don't even try to take credit for anything. I just do it and, you know, move on with my day, and it makes me happy.
Well, Anthony, thank you so much for sharing that. And Ryan, I'd love for you to weigh in on that. Is the pursuit of happiness in some ways a state of mind or a decision just to be more positive?
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at the science of happiness, there's two really obvious routes there. One is a cognitive, perception, right? So most of the work that's been done on gratitude, we see sort of changes our way of seeing the world and our way of interacting with individuals. But, you know, what the caller was mentioning that's really important is this other product, you know, the actual activities. So there's a random act of kindness that's happening, and that isn't just a change of a state of mind. It actually is a behavior, and buying a person a gallon of milk or doing something for them when they're not expecting it, you know, has this huge benefit of actually seeing the reciprocation, you know, usually displayed on the individual's face. So, and Gretchen mentioned this a little bit earlier. I thought it was a really excellent point that, you know, probably the single most important thing that you can do, you know, day in and day out is ensure that you're building quality, long-lasting bonds with other individuals. And that is not just necessarily a state of mind, but it also is something that you actually have to actively do. You can't just sort of sit there and think about your relationships. You actually have to go out and do something about them.
And Ryan, with your website, beyondthepurchase.org, you focus a lot on money. And again, you know, a lot of us, we seek money. We try to make money. We think that having more money will make our lives easier and therefore make us happier. But you focus a lot on how people can use their money in ways that actually do enhance their lives. What is the key to that?
Well, and another thing that Gretchen said that I really liked earlier was that, I mean, this has to be something that's very individualized. And so we look at one, you know, important heuristic because it tends to have all these benefits that comes along with it. And it's spending your money or at least your discretionary resources on life experiences as opposed to material items. And we have all these terrible forecasting errors that come along with material items. We see the sort of benefits of longevity and we think of all the uses of them. But for our discretionary resources, we really need to be focusing in on doing things that are true to who we are, but also, again, are going to bring us closer to our friends and family. And those are things like going to the park and going to events or going out to dinner or something as simple as just going out for a cup of coffee. And if you want to sort of combine all of the principles, you know, that you can find on sort of the money and happiness literature, one of the best things you could do is take a friend out, buy them a cup of coffee, buy them a, you know, a pop or a tea or something like that, sit down and have a good conversation, and you're going to build a good relationship with not spending a lot of money, and you'll be a lot happier as a result of it.
And you focus on the idea that a lot of us make decisions about how we spend money based mm-hmm. on how long we'll have something. So a lot of people will choose to buy a material object over spending money on an experience because the experience is fleeting. And the material object is there forever. But that seems to be it's something that doesn't make us happy.
So what happens is when people are sort of walking down the aisle to try and think about how they're going to spend their money, they see themselves as sort of positioning around two alternative worlds, one in which they can buy happiness and one in which they can sort of feel good about how they spent their money. You know, they got good value out of it. And so they see the tangibleness as this sort of reusability. And so we think of ourselves as, well, if I have this dinner, I'm going to, you know, spend a certain amount of money, but then it's going to be over. And what they discount is the fact that they're building a memory that they can go back to. And not only is that memory something they can go back to and relive and retell and talk to their friends and things like that, they also are going to have a memory that's not going to degrade. And what happens with material products is that you buy them and they're really nice and they're fun and you get this little buy high out of it. But what ends up ultimately happening is it starts to degrade and it needs to be replaced and it's not as good as someone else's iPad anymore. And so we really think about products and life experiences as two totally different types of purchases. And unfortunately, what happens is that after we make the purchase, most of our predictions about those were wrong. So one of the things that I think most positive psychologists advocate is that you're going to have to, in some sense, trust, you know, your instincts a little bit, but also have to learn a little bit about what the literature says, because sometimes you don't actually forecast your happiness as well as you think you do.
Interesting. Let's go back to the phones. Diane is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Well, you touched on it a bit, but I was going to say I went through a really rough divorce about 24 years ago. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, suddenly being a single mother with two young kids, that I made a decision at that point that I was going to have a happy life. And it has changed the frame in which all the rest of my life experiences occurred. I haven't had more or less necessarily challenges or hard times, but how I respond to them, maybe it's even which endorphins come up or whatever things. And I also just, so I mean, it, I think happiness is very much a decision. And if you look at the way people feel that they're either victims in life or whether or not they are their own agency, and it's not, I'm not saying, you know, for example, if somebody was, let's be really dramatic, if somebody is raped, I'm not saying you're happy about that. I'm not silly.
Right, right.
But how you work out and keep your psychic wholeness has a lot to do with what intentionality you bring to it. And the other thing, while I was on hold, I don't know if you mentioned it or not, I think the countries of Bhutan and Denmark, because I've done some study on a lot of this also, or if you ever do a second show, are interesting to bring to bear that they do the national indicator of happiness mm-hmm. in Bhutan
and we
how that has worked out.
We talked about Denmark this past winter and the idea of hygge, which is sort of a happiness or comfort idea as well. But Diane, that's a great story, and it sounds like you have really taken control of your life. And Gretchen, I mean, you write quite a bit about that, and it's a decision, but also some days there's even a little bit of fake it until you make it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there's a tension. On the one hand, you don't want to be inauthentic and you don't want to feel like you're faking your life and you're not being true to yourself, and that's a very important value. But on the other hand, as the caller was saying, like, sometimes, like, you can affect the way you look at something. You can find a way to be honestly enthusiastic, even if there's things maybe that you didn't love, or maybe, you know, you can really try to shape your responses mindfully so that you just try to get yourself into a better frame of mind. And one of the things that they've shown is that we often think that we act because of the way that we feel, but to a very great degree, we feel because of the way that we act. And so if you act the way you wish you felt, if you feel shy, you act friendly. If you feel low energy, you act, you know, you speed up your walk a little bit. You can change your emotions. It's very hard to set out to change your emotional state, but you can change your behavior. And a lot of times by changing your outward behavior, then you are able to influence your inward emotional state. And so by saying something like, you know what, I'm going to figure out a way to say that I loved that evening. You know, what was great about it? What am I grateful for? I didn't have to cook dinner. It wasn't exactly what I would have wanted, but on the other hand, I'm not doing the dishes or whatever. You know, you can direct yourself.
And we have just a couple of minutes left. And Dave, I want to ask you, we know so much more about happiness than we used to. And yet, I think we all probably know people who have set out to seek happiness or find themselves, who found themselves lost along the way because they don't have, the goal is so elusive. But how can we use this information that we know now to make good decisions?
Well, I think some of the ideas have been brought up. There's an acclaimed designer named Bruce Smile that talks about, I mean, he's a designer, but he talks about a good life. And he says a good life is often a product of good design, and a bad life often the opposite, the inverse. And I think that that we talked a little bit about habits, and certainly trusting in some of the important habits, the time and effort it takes for relationships will come back in those kind of dips in our lives to really repay unbelievable rewards for us. And so I think that design and designing our lives in ways that are positive, connecting to others, that are doing things larger than ourselves, are meaningful and fulfilling. I don't live in a fairy tale. I know bad things happen to good people, but I believe the end result will be truly as happy a life as we're able to live.
Dave, thank you very much. Dave Gould is an Olbermann Center public scholar. He teaches a life design class at the University of Iowa and is director of imagination for the Downtown Project in Las Vegas. Gretchen, thank you.
Thank you.
Gretchen Rubin is the best-selling author of The Happiness Project and blogs at GretchenRubin.com. And Ryan, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan Howell is associate professor of psychology at San Francisco State University and co-founder of BeyondThePurchase.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.